tell you about two distinct topics that are related by the fundamental role that the free boundary problem for the Laplacian plays in both of them. So I want to start with gravitational allocation. So to get to explain this picture, which is related so the picture was drawn by Manju Krishnapur. It's related to work both of Misha Sodin with Cyrilson and with Nazarov and Goldberg, and with my own work that I'll come to next. Now, so let me start with the topic of gravitational allocation to Poisson points. So this is joint work with Shourav Chatterjee, Ron Tellett, and Dan Romick. See if this will make it better. Yeah. And so the kind of problem we start out with, and I want to emphasize now the problem because other physical ideas can perhaps yield other solutions to this problem. The problem is the fair allocation of Lebesgue measure to a point process. So we have a random collection of points in the plane with some invariance properties, say translation invariance. And it can be then, later it will be not just in the plane, but in higher dimensional space as well. And what we want is to allocate to each point of the process a unit of volume. But heuristically speaking, this allocation should be without any central authority. Somehow the points should themselves find a way to divide the volume. Mathematically, what we want is that the allocation is just a function of the point process, and this function is translation invariant. If we move the points, then the allocation moves with it, and it doesn't involve any additional randomization. So, so here are two examples of such an allocation. Maybe I'll make a bigger picture of the left one, which is the stable allocation. So this is a picture drawn by Andor Holroyd, and what is this? So we start with a random collection of centers. Each one grows a disk at unit rate, and these disks and it acquires area, so every center acquires all the area it reached first. Okay? So if we would just do that, we would get a different picture. We would get the Voronoi tessellation, where different centers have very different areas. So what we change is every center, when it grows its disk, it keeps track of how much area it has acquired, and when it's acquired its fair share, it stops growing. So again, in a finite region, we have, you know, area 300 points. Each one is trying to acquire area of exactly one, no more than its fair share. It's growing the disk, keeping track of the area it acquired. And so you see this point here acquired area one, all nearby, but some points that are more hemmed in have to go out further. And so if you look at, say, this point here, it acquires some area right nearby, but then the disk keeps growing. But it's not acquiring area here because all the points it's reaching have been reached earlier by other points. Finally, out here, it finds some area that it wants, and other points, other closer points are already sated, they're no longer hungry. So this point acquires this area, and it completes its allotment of the unit area. So this allocation has some interesting properties, but it also has some deficiencies. For instance, the territory is allocated to different centers. You know, some centers are not connected. And also, one thing we're interested in is how far does the center need to go until it is sated? And for this, so for this allocation, we conjecture that in any dimension, the probability you have to go distance r away is r to the minus 2 over d. In particular, in dimension 2 it should be 1 over r. Until recently we didn't have any bound for it. Now, recently in joint work with the and the Holroyd or the Tram, Robin P. Mantle, we know some power law bounds, but not the sharp ones. So that was one allocation scheme. There's a completely different allocation scheme that is in this picture. So, and this is, I mentioned this idea was started by Sodin and Cyrilson, who implemented it the idea was for zeros of Gaussian analytic functions. I'll tell you about that in a moment. But let me first describe what the intuitive idea is. So we have our random points. Here there are these black points. Think of each one of them as having some, as creating a gravity force field. And here I'm not using the terminology in the original Sodin-Cyrilson description, but in our related view of it. So again, each one of them applies a force which is proportional to 1 over distance to the d minus 1, if you're in d dimensions. And these black points, these black centers are not moving. They apply the force to all other points in the plane. Every point in the plane feels the total force coming from all the other points and moves accordingly, but doesn't exactly move according to Newton's law. The force here is used as a velocity rather than as an acceleration. And it moves according to this gradient field, and except for boundary effects, most points will fall into a certain one of the stars. Now the remarkable thing, which is just a consequence of Green's formula, is that each of these, that under suitable assumptions, each of these regions will have exactly the same area. So it's an allocation scheme, and it has connected regions. So I want to tell you a little bit more about this. Now, by the way, this picture, although I drew for you a two-dimensional picture, this, as it's stated, it doesn't work for Poisson process in two dimensions. And nothing so perhaps one can find some variant that will work for Poisson in two dimensions. But right now, what we know is from the work of Sodin, Nazarov-Volberg, we know it for zeros of Gaussian analytic functions in the plane, and from our work, we know it for Poisson processes in three and higher dimensions.
So what goes wrong with
the? I'll tell you. But basically, the first thing that goes wrong is that the force doesn't converge. So to define the force, you have to sum the series, and it's a series with random terms. Okay, and such series sometimes converge and sometimes they don't. In this case, the Poisson, they don't. Okay, so as I said, we're looking for invariant allocation rules, just functions. You can think of them as functions from Euclidean space to the point process. And one variable we're interested in is the diameter of a region. So for instance, look at the origin is a point in space. Look at its center and look at the diameter of all the points that are in the same region as the origin. So that's a random variable of interest, especially in scales. So we'd like to get the regions to be as with small diameter as possible. Since this is a random quantity, we'd like the diameters to have a fast decay of tail as possible. Now there are some absolute limitations. For instance, in the plane, we know that any allocation, say to Poisson process, will have to have this x non-integrable. So this decay cannot be very fast in the plane. In higher dimensions, the story is different. So.
Could you move to full screen?
Yeah. So.
Thanks.
since I'm here in UCLA, I should say something about how we got interested in allocations, because it's connected to work, earlier work of Thorsen and of Liggett, to the problem of extra head rules. So, so our original probabilistic motivation came from a remarkable discovery of Thorsen, Hermann Thorsen, namely, if you have a Poisson, I'll describe one version of it, if you have a Poisson process in space, he gave a theoretical proof that you can always give a kind of an existence proof, you can always find the point of the process, shift that point to the origin, shifting the whole process with it, so that if you then remove that point, what you get is a perfect Poisson process with the original distribution. If you think about it for a bit, that's a little surprising. The first things you would try to do, say shift the closest point or anything like that, is going to completely destroy the distribution. And in this, there was a continuous and discrete version of this fact. In the discrete case, and especially in the one-dimensional case, Tom Liggett gave an explicit way to realize this to realize this extra head rule, and later, after joint work with Holroyd, we realized this problem is essentially equivalent to the allocation problem. Namely, if you have an allocation, what you can do is just look where the origin is allocated. It's allocated. Suppose you have a good allocation for Poisson. Look where the origin is allocated, and then the center that the origin is allocated, that's the one you want to move to the origin. And if you do that, and then remove that center, everything else is a perfect Poisson process. So that's an identity. And we also showed that that's the only way to get an extra head rule. If you have an extra head rule, it has to come from such an allocation. So it really reduces the probabilistic problem. This one, but then allocations have this interesting geometry that was there to investigate.
Might I inquire, you've mentioned on a couple of occasions, with one specific example, that in two dimensions, the Poisson process is problematic. Can you explain exactly what the origin of the difficulty? Is it large gaps between the points that happen occasionally, or crowding?
Large fluctuations in density, both overcrowding and undercrowding, is what. What creates the difficulty for Poisson, and the fact that in a box, in an R by R box, the fluctuation is of order R, which is the same as the boundary which you have to work with. Mm-hmm. So once you're in three and higher dimensions, you have enough connections to go out of the boundary to take care of those fluctuations. But in two dimensions, it's somehow exactly critical, and you don't have enough.
But then, all right, so this is also a familiar problem with random magnets, random field in a magnet. So but then it doesn't sound like it's just the Poisson process, sort of anything,
It's really a problem of fluctuations, and the two-dimensional processes, which are well understood, have much tighter. For these allocations have much tighter, smaller fluctuations. Okay, so
could we just have a look at the previous slide?
Yes, sure. So. I could, of course, go off. This is a direction that we could discuss for another hour, but just wanted to tell you about it. And so as I mentioned, in one and two dimensions, we know that any allocation rule has to have its d over 2 moment infinite. So in one dimension, the half moment has to be infinite. In two dimensions, the first moment has to be infinite. And this is, closely linked to work of Liggett and Liggett and Holroyd. In this formulation, it's in an analyst probability paper with Holroyd. But I want to go over to the gravitational location, and as I mentioned, that started with, you know, with not something that looks very different from Poisson. So, zeros of this Gaussian analytic function. I think one thing I enjoy about this work is that I, you know, as probabilists, we learn first that Poisson is the simplest point process. Before you do anything about other point processes, you look at the Poisson. Here's the case of something going the other way. It is for this process, or for this for the allocation problem, it turns out that the zeros of this random function are more amenable to analysis, a better thing to look at first than the Poisson process, because for this it turns out the gravitational potential is very natural. And once you understand that, you can build on that to do the Poisson process, which is for which this problem is harder. Okay, so this is a series, right? Infinite series, it converges in the whole plane. The xions here are IID complex Gaussian. So their real and imaginary part are standard Gaussian. And already one easy but remarkable fact is that the zeros of this form a translation invariant process. Okay, so I'm not going to prove that for you here, but refer you, for instance, to the papers of Misha Sodin, which has one to hear some expository papers on this series. And now, the cell of each zero is defined as basis of attraction of the gradient flow, and the gradient flow is given by, well, z minus the gradient of log absolute value of f. Maybe another way to think about it is in terms of this potential. So you take the potential function, which is log absolute of f minus half z squared. Where is this coming from? So although I told you that the zeros here are translation invariant, the function itself doesn't have a translation invariant distribution. And to get the translation invariant distribution, you have to multiply it by an exponential of this. So that's one motivation for this additional factor. So here is a rough picture, again due to Manju Krishnapur, of this potential. So you see that the potential will take values minus infinity at the zeros of the original function. But it's still, one can readily understand this potential, and then it's harder if you want to understand it very well, as they did. So you can think of the domains, this intuitively, by thinking you put a pebble on the surface and see in which hole it will roll into when you have, you know, a lot of friction here. And that partitions the underlying plane into regions, and then these regions have equal area. And the remarkable thing they showed here about this, Nazarov, Sodin, Goldberg, is that the regions have diameter which decays like e to the minus r log r to the 3 halves. So here is a sketch of the proof of why these regions have equal area. So can I look at some basin B of Z, take N outward pointing normal, and now integrate F times N. I want to show you these domains again. So we're going to take an integral of the force times the normal over these boundaries. Well, on the boundaries, the force is parallel to the boundary, so the force times the normal is going to be zero. So that's this equation. Now, if you think of, take the distributional divergence of f, you get a 2, so this comes from the half, the half z squared term, and then 2 pi times Dirac masses at the at the singularities of the force. Remember, the force was just, or the potential was, well, flip its sign, so it's half z squared minus log of the absolute value of the function. So you get this for the divergence, and now you write the divergence theorem, so this integral should be 0, but what is this integral? You get twice the volume minus 2 pi. So you get it because each of these domains of attraction has only a single mass inside. So so when you integrate this over the region, you just get 2 pi. You have a single Dirac mass contributing. So you get this. So you get that the volume of every region here is exactly pi. And this, this Gaussian analytic function, I told you that the distribution of zeros is translation invariant, and the intensity is not 1, it's 1 over pi here. So, fine. What? Right. There's easier ways to see that. Okay. So I'm going to skip some additional points about that and go over to the process I was most interested in, the Poisson. And after hearing of this work about the Gaussian analytic functions, but to see what would be the analog of that for Poisson, and so you look at it for a bit, you realize that the relevant force should have this form, so it should just be the Newtonian gravitational force, but summed over all, so the z's will now be the centers, the points of the process. And you sum it over all z's. Here the force applied at x, and you sum it, to be concrete, you sum it in increasing order of distance from x. And the idea is you can think of the force before. Remember, it was the gradient of log of absolute value of f with a correction term. So the potential was harmonic. So here we also want to work with the harmonic potential. So we use the fact that the Newtonian gravity is the gradient of the standard radial harmonic function in Euclidean space. So that's one motivation here. Now, of course, this kind of force, because standard Newtonian force, it was investigated even for Poisson points before, in particular by Chandrasekhar in 1942. And he already found that this force, so just as a very theoretical cosmological model, thinking of the universe as infinite and stars as Poisson points, he found that the force at a point converges in dimension 3 and higher, but divergent in dimension 2. We quickly go through the version of the explanations. So if you look at the Poisson process in dimension d, zi's are these points, absolute value zi's, their distance from the origin. Then if you take absolute value zi to the dth power, then that will be a Poisson process on the positive line. So you can easily see that because the distances between successive terms here will be exponential variables. So if you take absolute value of zi, if zi are Poisson process in d dimensions, absolute value of zi is going to grow like I to the 1 over d. This ratio will just converge to a constant. So that's an easy standard fact. Now, condition on all these absolute values. So we have our stars in condition on what spheres around the origin they lie. And after that, each star is just uniform on the sphere we condition it on. And now if you take Zi over absolute value of Zi to the d, remember that's, we're computing the force acting at the origin. So the force is just, remember, it's inverse proportional to the distance to the power d minus 1. So we can write it as Zi, the force itself, as Zi over absolute value of Zi to the d. So this is a random variable. Remember, we conditioned on these absolute values. So this has mean 0. And for variance, just use the square as the squared size as the bound that gives you the right order. So absolute value is Zi to the minus 2, d minus 1. And now you plug in, remember that Zi has this order, and what you get is I to this power minus 2, d minus 1 over d. And now you see that if d is 2, then what you get here is a harmonic series for the variances. Some of the variances diverge, so for this, so you know, the variables fail the Kolmogorov 3-series test, and so the variables, this sum diverges almost surely. Mm-hmm. However, once you take d3 and higher, then you get a convergent series of variances, and so the original series converges. One thing to emphasize is that even in higher dimensions, although the series of variances converges, so the series of random variables will converge almost surely, it does not converge absolutely. So this tells us this order matters. Right? Series that converges but not absolutely, if you sum it, then you have to say what the order is. So the order that the gravity acts plays a role here, and that's why I gave you a specific order. The order according to distance, so when the gravity acts on x, the order is according to the distance from x. I'll come back to this issue of order, but there's another nice fact found by Chandrasekhar. Not only for in dimension 3 and higher, we can say what is the distribution. The distribution is a symmetric stable distribution. And there's an easy reason for this. Suppose we want to add n copies of the force at the origin. How can we do that? Well, we just take n copies of the Poisson process and think of them as acting together. We take a union of n copies of the Poisson process. But n copies of the Poisson process taken together is just the Poisson process scaled by a factor of n to the minus 1 over d. And so this has the same law, adding the force at the origin, adding n independent copies of the force at the origin, has the same law as scaling the force at the origin by this power, because we scale the Poisson process by this power, and remember that the force has a power d minus 1 in it, so we get this identity, and that's one of the descriptions of stability for random variables. Adding independent copies is the same as multiplying the original variable by some power of n, if we have n copies, some power of n times itself. And so we get stability, and it's easy to see that this variable has to be spherically symmetric. Now I mentioned that the order matters, order of summation matters. But how much does it matter? Suppose instead of summing the force in increasing distance from x, we sum it in increasing distance from the origin. We need to do that if we want to think of this force as defining a differential equation, because you're in studying how smooth are the solutions of this equation. You don't want the equations themselves to involve a sum where the order of summation changes with the point. That's kind of unpleasant if you try to differentiate stuff like that. So you want to sum around a specific, to have a fixed order of summation in defining. So we wanted to change your estimation from something around x, the point where the force acts, to something around the fixed point, say the origin. Well, intuitively we thought, how much could that matter? I mean, for the first few points it seems to matter, but after you go very far, then increasing distance from the origin or increasing distance from x are about the same thing. The point is very, very far, so it shouldn't matter that much. Well, it does matter, but by a constant amount. So here is the relevant fact. Suppose you sum in increasing order from some point u. You look at the force acting on x in increasing order from the point u. And you compare this for two choices. One here is u and here is v. But the force is always acting on the same point x. And then the difference between these two, these series both converge for u and for v. So that's easy with the variance test. Their sums, however, are not the same. They differ by a deterministic constant, which is just u minus v times the volume of the unit ball. So you have two random series. They converge. They're changing only by the order of summation, and the difference is this deterministic constant. Now, it's easy to see why we would expect the difference to be deterministic. Because if you take one star and move it, that's going to affect the sum around u, it's going to affect the sum around v, but eventually it's going to affect them by the same amount. So when we subtract, when we look at this difference, it's not going to depend on the location of any specific star. If you move it, it's going to cancel in this, when you sum these series, it's going to eventually cancel. So you have a random variable that's in the tail sigma algebra of all these Poisson points. It doesn't depend on any finite collection of them. Hence, it has to be constant almost surely, Kolmogorov, version of Kolmogorov 0-1 law. But still, it was surprising that this constant isn't just zero. But once you know it's a constant, you can figure out its size by looking at expectations. So, and using some, bringing back some high school physics. So the, once you look at expectations, maybe it's, here. So maybe it's easiest if I explain this point on the board. So let's just do the case. Here is the origin. Here is x, and we want to look at the difference in the force acting on x when we sum around the origin and when we sum around x. So. So let's just divide space into these spheres, and since we're doing so we're going to compute the difference in expectation. The average of the Poisson process is just uniform mass. So the question is just to find the effect of a uniform mass on x, but when the uniform mass is grown around the origin as opposed to the uniform mass grown around x. Now, if we look at spheres around the origin, what is their gravity effect on x? Well, it depends how large the sphere is. Like if this sphere is big enough that it encompasses x, then its gravity on x is zero. Right? That's the one high school fact we're using. On the other hand, if the sphere is smaller than the radius of x, then its effect on x is just the same as if we contracted it and put the same mass at zero. So that's so when we compute the difference in expectations, we get the contribution from all the spheres until the radius of x, and that and after that the contribution is zero, and that's the source. So we get a difference which is proportional to just this vector connecting the origin to x, or in this more general setting, just proportional to the vector connecting u and v. So to rigorize this one, that's the variance calculation that I'll skip. And as I said before, we divide space. We use this to divide space using this equation, gamma dot is f of gamma t, is the, where f is that force, and the same kind of green function argument, with some more worry about the smoothness, could be used to show that the volumes of the regions have the volumes of the gravitational allocation rule domain basins of attraction are all equal. And all that is somehow the soft part and the fun part of the construction. The hard work is proving an analog of what Sodi, Lazar, and Fulbert did in this setting, and our analogs are not as sharp. We can't say what is the right power of log here, but we do know that the tails decay exponentially. The lower bounds are not as good as the spar. So you shouldn't take too seriously the powers of log here, but so they're correct but not sharp. But the basic message is that for this allocation, the tails decay exponentially, and we don't have anything else coming from any other method that is a concrete, deterministic, invariant allocation that does as well or nearly as well. That is, the other methods that are more intuitive algorithmically all have power laws that aren't so good. They don't have exponential decay. Okay, so I'm going to skip the details of why this works. Yes?
I have a question. So I thought that somehow when you reach 3 and after it, it's more or less the same, right? So you think that the exponents there would be connected somehow. You plug in z equals 3 and 3.
Yeah. Well, really from 5 on it's the same. And 3 and 4 require extra care. The reason is that I talked about the, so this I can explain, I talked about the invariant force, but in the proofs it's very convenient to be able to work with an invariant potential. So to sum not just the force, but to sum the potential. And if you do the same calculation as I did for summing the potential, then you see that will converge only in dimension 5 and higher. So in dimension 3 and 4, you can define a potential by integrating the force, but you can't define an invariant potential. Mm-hmm. So really in dimension 3 and 4, you have to do more ad hoc things, and we really know that the behavior of the of three, especially three dimensions, is different than in higher dimensions. Just maybe one word about the rough methods that are used to show the exponential decay. They are basically dependent percolation ideas. So, and here it was crucial for us that we had as a guide the earlier work in the Gaussian analytic function case, so about half of our work was just following their methods and adapting them. And then we had to add something more because in our case the potential is much less well behaved. Their potential was the log of an analytic function, so we had very good control over it. In our case, our potential was this unwieldy sum that every little change in it changes. But it turned out that a lot of the methods worked, and the idea is to show so if there's a box of radius r, another box of radius 2r, we want to bound the probability that there is some gradient curve that goes from the boundary of this box to the boundary of this box, and again that in very very roughly is done by dividing into smaller boxes and saying, well, if a gradient curve goes this huge distance, so this is the huge distance r, then what could happen? Either we have a huge potential difference between these two points. That we can rule out a priori because the, and again, this takes some work. So So suppose there's no big potential difference between these points. Then how could we have such a long gradient curve? Remember, along the gradient curve, the potential is monotonic. So the potential must not be changing very much over this very long interval. So if we look at the divide into small squares, we must have a lot of squares here where the force is small, where the force is the gradient of the potential. So the force has to be small along a lot of boxes here. Now, remember, the force has this distribution we do understand, but, well, since Chandrasekhar in 1942, that it's a distribution. It doesn't have an atom of the origin. Force is not, doesn't like to be very small. So the first idea would be to apply a percolation argument to say the probability of a path like this, where all the forces are very small, would be tiny if we could just multiply the probability. Of course, whether the force is small here and whether the force is small here are not independent events, and so one has to control for this dependence. And for that, you partition the force into the effect of the faraway star and the close star, and control in some uniform way the effect of the faraway stars. And then for the effect of the close stars, you do have some only short range dependence. So the dependent percolation type argument will work. So this is a standard variant of percolation where instead of looking at long open paths, you just ask for long paths where a larger than expected fraction of the edges are open, and you can control that as well. Mm-hmm. So,
but isn't there, from the faraway stars, isn't there some slow decay, a small but slow decay of the dependence of these boxes? So just. What,
yes.
If I have two small boxes that are well separated, what is the correlation between their occupation? Isn't that a problem?
Between the forces being small.
Yeah.
Yes, but really the 2-point correlation is not enough. We want to be able to multiply a lot of these.
I'm aware of that. I'm worried about just the opposite. It's
uh-huh.
too much. Not that it's not enough.
Okay. So it is that although the forces, the overall forces have a substantial correlation. But
yeah.
Once you even condition on the effect of the faraway stars. Then, in order for the forces to be very small in both of these squares, the local stars have to align themselves just right to cancel the effect of the faraway stars. Look at a little square, okay, a little cube. In order for the force there to be small, suppose you already know the effect of the faraway stars. In order for the force there to be small, the nearby stars have to align just right to cancel that faraway effect. And then in the other square that's further out here, you also have a effect from the faraway stars. That effect is highly correlated with the effect here. But again, to cancel that effect, you need a special alignment of the local stars that will cancel it. And that's an independent event. Unfortunately, the whole story takes 68 pages, but it does work.
So there has to be then some notion of condition somehow in the far field, then you have rapid decay of correlations.
Yes. And, I mean, the actual proof involves computing
mm-hmm.
big Jacobians.
Mm-hmm.
I'm giving a rough idea of it, and then we started at 9:05, so I have just a few minutes to tell you about the other topic that I wanted to mention, which is the rotor-rooter model, which is a variant of deterministic variant of internal DLA. So you put particles at the center, and keep moving them according to the arrows. So let's put it. So when a particle starts at the center, next particle starts at the center. First, the arrow rotates by 90 degrees. then the particle moves according to the arrow, then this place is still occupied, so the arrow will be rotated, the particle will move. This place is unoccupied, so the particle will settle here.
Rotation is random?
What?
Rotation.
There's nothing random, so rotation is by 90 degrees to the right. Okay? Clockwise. It's a completely deterministic model. Again, the new particle starts here, the arrow rotates by 90 degrees and moves, rotates by 90 degrees, moves, until it settles here. So what I'm describing here is a model that was the model of Eulerian walkers was initiated by physicists. Krizhev et al. Is the first paper I know. Then thinking of this as an aggregation model is an idea of Jim Propp, and then this work and the simulation is, well, the simulation is due to Lionel Levine, and this is joint work with Lionel Levine. Well, what is this going to look like after we have a lot of points? Well, now we make it move faster, and it's looking like a disk. So, okay. So our theorem is that indeed it has a scaling limit of a disk, but the reality is much sharper than anything we can prove. So that's the challenge here. We go to the pictures. Okay, so this is a picture. After, you know, if we had more patience, we could wait for a million particles to start at the origin, then we get this picture. And here the difference of the in radius and the out radius is less than 2. That never exceeds 1.74 throughout the process.
What's in radius, what's out radius?
So the distance from the center to the closest point and to the closest point on the outside would be the in radius, and the distance to the furthest point in the region would be the out radius.
It looks like it's 1.
What?
It looks like the ratio is 1 here.
Of course the ratio is 1. The difference.
Oh, the difference. Okay.
The difference is small. So okay. The ratio, so I say of course the ratio is 1, but this was Jim Propp's question, which we have now shown that the in radius and the out radius have a ratio going to 1. I should say, but the bounds we can prove are much weaker than what the simulations indicate. So simulations indicate that the difference seems to stay bounded. What we can show is that so you have a theoretical radius after n points have come in. You have a theoretical radius of square root of n over pi, and we can show that the in radius is at least that except for a log correction, but again an additive log correction. So it's root n over pi minus constant log n is a lower bound, and but on the outer boundary we can't do as well. We have an n to the quarter mistake there. Now these are, we're sure these are artifacts of our proofs, and especially some part, especially the outer bound, it uses the relation between this and the random process. So if all the decisions are done at random, instead of rotating the arrows deterministically, you get what's known as internal DLA that was analyzed earlier. And here's a picture of IDLA run.
Do colors have any meaning here in this picture?
Yes, deep meaning. So
what was that structure you could see on the other side?
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Well,
look. So first, this is IDLA. Everything is the same except that the arrows are chosen at random at each stage instead of rotating deterministically. So you do get a disk. This is a theorem of Gramson, Lawler, and Griffith from the early 90s. And there you see that the boundary is rougher. And so our proof for the rotor-router case, for the inner boundary, we use a new, better method, which is why we get the log error. But for the outer boundary, we had to resort to something, using their method and approximating the deterministic by the random. So that's why we can't get the true understanding of that. Now, what do the colors mean? The color, remember when we had that simulation, the color changed every time the arrow rotated. So the color represents the last direction that the particle left the site. Let's go back. Where was the rotor? So here have this remarkable pattern inside. Now, what you see, these patches are areas where the color is about constant, right? So that's these visible patches. And it turns out if you apply the map z goes to 1 over z squared, so normalize this to be the unit disk, apply the map z goes to 1 over z squared, this goes to a lattice. That's an experimental observation. There's no proof of anything about the patterns. And it's clear that if you could, I mean, that's the most interesting thing here, to understand these patterns. Now, in the, so the proofs of this do involve getting somewhere. So what's the connection to the main part of the talk? The connection is, look at the odometer function for this model. So at every point, look at how many particles were emitted from the site. Okay, and this, so for that function, well, suppose that x is not the origin. How many particles were emitted from x? Well, all the particles that arrived at x arrived from one of the four neighbors. So, so this should be, and the neighbors divide their mass equally. So this should be the average sum over y neighbor of x of u of y, except that one particle that arrived at x stayed there. So you get this kind of equation, right? Which is, again, the discrete Laplacian, the discrete Laplacian of u equals 1. And the discrete Laplacian at the origin is 1 minus n, because at the origin we had n particles to begin with. So the scaling limit of this equation is, again, an equation that says the Laplacian of u is a constant minus a Dirac mass. And it's really understanding that kind of free boundary problem. Now, for one point, it's a disk. So I have, okay, one more quick thing to say. So if we, one is that this isn't really right for the rotor-router, because the average, the the number of turns is not an integer, and the error you get from that can easily swamp out this one. So the error that you get from that is of constant order. So you have to do some smoothing to say that that error really doesn't matter that much, and that's kind of the substantial element of the work here. Finally, let me just show you one last picture. So this is what happens when you start from two sources. Okay, you start from two sources, and there we also have a proof of the existence of a scaling limit, and the scaling limit is again comes from that kind of equation, Laplacian of u equals a constant minus sum of two Dirac masses. We don't have a formula for what the boundary looks like, so that's connected to understanding that free boundary problem. But again, these patterns are remarkably persistent. So whatever you try to do to the model, these patterns still appear. Okay, let me stop here.